The smell was overpowering. This current epoch so much replicated the 1960s that it sometimes felt uncanny. Although the shape of the vessel was a little odd, rather like the barrel of a smallish deck cannon, within it, over a dancing candle flame, chocolate melted. Emma was making fondue. Fresh strawberries and thick slices of banana were set out on two smallish plates, one to either side of the vessel itself at the center of the coffee table. Rourke sat on the couch. Emma Shaw knelt on the opposite side of the table. She stabbed a piece of banana with one of the small, tined, long-handled forks. Rourke speared a strawberry.
What will you do when this war with Eden is come and gone, John?
I'll wait for the next war.
That's a terrible thing to say.
I'm speaking from experience, Emma, not from preference. After we ended things with the Soviet Union, I started up my clinic, my hospital. My wife and I were living together. Our baby was due. Aside from Commander Dodd and the political strife which he was attempting to generate within Eden, things looked positive. It's almost as if mankind can't live without strife, though. Perhaps it's some fault in our genetic makeup. There are some people who will risk everything, of theirs and everyone else's, in order to try for power over mankind. Nazi, communist, doesn't really matter. Rose by any other name, the result's the same.
You're a pessimist.
You're almost right. I'm a realist. The intent is different, but the result's the same, I'm afraid.
Fine. Then say by some miracle it becomes an ideal world. What then?
I'd like to explore it, see what's out there. And if we ever got a space program going, which won't be in my lifetime because we're too busy trying to survive, see what's out there as well. But I'd probably try to bring my medical education up to the level of the present century and then go back to the doctor business. A lot depends, well, everything, really, depends on whether or not Sarah can be saved now. And Dietrich Zimmer's the only man who can do it, it appears, if indeed he can.
What would you do if the bullet in her brain can't be removed? If she can't be awakened, John?
Once that's certain, that no process currently known could save her, I take the sleep again and stay with her until the day she can be brought back.
Even considering everything, your wife's a lucky woman.
I know you meant that as a compliment, but I don't know how lucky she is to have me for a husband. Sometimes I think I'm a curse to her, but she'd do the same for me, I know. But there'll be a way of making Dietrich Zimmer do what has to be done.
Then?
Then Zimmer and Martin will have to be stopped.
You'd kill your own son?
Dead men lay everywhere aft of the superstructure. Two of Doring's own band were wounded, but neither seriously. Marie attended them as Reinhardt led a team to set the charges that would sink this vessel to the bottom. Such had been Doring's plan all along. The opportunity presented by Captain Dimitri's attack actually heightened the potential for effectiveness. Gunther Brach, with two of the men, kept the remainder of the pirate crew pinned down below decks with energy weapons fire so that the demolitions party and the boat party, which Doring himself led, could go about their business unmolested. Doring, on the floating jetty beside the rusting hull of the antique vessel, looked to the main deck.
We are ready down here.
Laying the last charges now, Willie.
Had they been able to depart the Vladivostok Queen without incident, they would have lain off just over the horizon, and two of the men would have gone back using scuba gear and laid magnetic charges on the hydrofoil and laterally along the underside of the hull. The effect would have been to rip the vessel open and sink it in two halves, fore and aft. The advantage provided them under the present circumstances was significant. By skillful placement of the charges, the pirate hydrofoil could be made to collapse in on itself. It would sink faster that way, and there was vastly reduced chance of any survivors. Doring had realized that if somehow Dimitri and his crew could have seen any profit in contacting the authorities at Pearl Harbor and alerting them that a party of Nazi commandos had quietly infiltrated the islands, they would have done so. This had been obvious from the first. As they had crossed the Tropic of Cancer, Doring came to the realization that Dimitri, instead of seeking some dubious reward for betraying them, might be contemplating a more direct assault on them. That had happened. Dimitri, disarmed and not yet fully bled to death from his gaping wound, still knelt on his own deck. Doring patted the hilt of the dagger which he had retrieved from Dimitri's crotch. The blade, as an extension of his hand, had done its work well. Doring looked to the boats. All three were inflated, twin outboards mounted, gear stowed.
Doring. One of you stay with the boats. The rest of you follow me up to the top. We get the wounded.
As Doring reached the main deck and swung through the gap in the rail, he saw Marie, her blue eyes wide, her skin more pale than usual. She was just completing a bandage. Women were ill-suited to anything but domestic or basic clerical duties, but a female was necessary to the operation, and Marie was as good as any. Once the team became known to the American authorities in the Hawaiian Islands, security would naturally be tightened. A woman, uninvolved directly in the raids, would be able to move more freely than a man. Her English was perfect. He gave her that.
Marie, help put the wounded into the boats.
Yes, Willie.
The charges are set, Willie.
Good.
I will be able to radio detonate from 200 meters away. We will be safe from any flying debris. There are little redundancies built into the charges so that they can neither be disarmed nor neutralized. So!
Good!
Then he went to stand before Captain Dimitri. The pirate captain's body was so bent over that his forehead rested against one of the deck plates.
Captain, we must leave you now. But it was a pleasant voyage. And you shall have the ultimate sea captain's honor. I have always read that the captain must go down with his ship. This you will do.
Oh, fuck you!
That is a trait of you which I would have never expected, Captain. But if you wish to fantasize... Gunther! When we are safely aboard the inflatables, withdraw!
Yes, Willie!
He'd shaken her hand. Her right arm hung limp at her side. From the small porch, she could watch the taillights of his car as they became smaller and smaller and smaller. In another moment, they would disappear. The shawl across her nearly bare shoulders, not too terribly heavy, Emma Shaw was cold. But she stood there alone on the front porch, watching the vanishing taillights anyway. She had made the ultimate mistake any woman could make. She was in love with a man who was totally unattainable. But that was not the reason that she loved him. There was no reason to it. And that, more than anything, at once terrified her, yet convinced her that what she felt was very real, perhaps her ultimate reality. And that terrified her even more. It was unthinkable that John Rourke would suddenly take her into his arms and ravage her body as he'd ravaged her soul almost from the very first instant she'd seen him. Emma Shaw could no longer really see the lights from his car, but she stood there anyway. The wind raised her dress. She made no move to touch the skirt, to hold it down. Her arms hung so limply at her sides now that the shawl had slipped from her shoulders, clung to her only at her elbows.
John.
She'd always enjoyed the writings of Albert Camus, the 20th century French existentialist. A story she'd always remembered was his classic, The Unfaithful Wife. But she was not about to bear her body to the stars on the roof of some desert hovel. And it wasn't as if she hadn't bared her body on a few occasions before. She wanted to strip away her clothes, wear only John Rourke's arms around her. That would be enough, forever. But he wasn't here, and he wouldn't be. The faithful husband. If she were a writer, she could write a story about him. A man garbed in the righteousness of his fidelity to a wife who was all but dead. Yet Emma Shaw could not bring herself to hate Sarah Rourke. She envied her. And that was funny, envying a woman who had slept for 125 years in suspended animation with a bullet in her brain that in all likelihood could never be removed. The thought that crossed her mind made her feel colder and more alone than any wind or any night. John, when Sarah could not be brought back, would re-enter what he so offhandedly called the sleep and wait with her. While John slept with his almost dead wife, she, Emma Shaw, might sleep with others, but never sleep with him. And the great love of her life would quite literally pass her by. When he reawoke, she would be dead, gone, hardly a memory. Or worse, he would reawaken, about 40 or so as he was now, and she, Emma Shaw, would be alive and old and near death, and John would come to visit her, laugh with her about this dinner tonight, pat her gently on a wrinkled hand, perhaps brush his lips against her cheek, and then death would be a blessing. She was conscious in that instant that tears were flooding her eyes. She could have turned her eyes into the wind, made them go away, but she let them flow from the rims of her eyes and across her cheeks. She tasted the salt of her own tears on her lips. It was bitter. Marie sat, hugging her knees close to her, her eyes riveted to the pirate ship Vladivostok Queen. Willie had told her to watch.
Oh.
Marie Dreisling shivered, despite the blanket one of the men had thrown over her shoulders. The men aboard the Vladivostok Queen, all of them, would soon die. Marie Dreisling knew they were enemies, but they were human beings. That was why she was glad to be a woman. Such a decision as this, to kill these men, was a decision she could never have made. That was something only a man could do.
All right, now watch, Marie. The explosions will have a ripple effect, sawing the damn ship in two!
She had expected flames, pieces of burning debris, perhaps a mushroom-shaped fireball rising into the night sky, turning the darkness to day. But there were only bright flashes. The engines of all three inflatables purred into life. The sea churned more wildly. The three inflatables were hydroplaning now, and the rolling of the seas felt less pronounced in her stomach. And the Vladivostok Queen sank beneath the waves. John Thomas Rourke felt little like sleeping. He spent some time keening the edge of the Crane Life Support System 10 knife, then touching up the A.G. Russell Sting 1A Black Chrome's edges as well. He took his vintage copy of Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged from his suitcase and picked up where he'd last stopped rereading when other matters had drawn him away. He read that for a time, but couldn't concentrate. He thought of Sarah and the inevitability of his future should he live long enough to meet it. By the time the day came that Sarah would be restored to him, young Martin Zimmer, their son, kidnapped at birth and raised by the Nazi Dietrich Zimmer, then genetically altered to mirror the image of Dietrich Zimmer's idol, Adolf Hitler, would be dead. John Rourke would have to see to that in one manner or another. Precipitating the death of his own son, however evil and vile that life had become, would be the second most difficult thing he would ever have to do. For all that Dietrich Zimmer had done, the ultimate responsibility for young Martin being in the world was John Rourke's, his and his alone. He alone had made Sarah pregnant with the child. And but for the circumstances of the child's birth, Sarah might well have been beside him. They could have lived out the rest of their lives, he and Sarah, in relative normalcy. And together, they would be in their graves by now, knowing nothing of this future which the begetting of Martin Zimmer helped to create. The most difficult thing, even more than taking the life of young Martin, would be telling Sarah that he had done it, and losing her forever as a consequence. She would assume, as any mother would, that somehow Martin could have been changed back for the good. But what Dietrich Zimmer had done to the boy, through a combination of genetic surgery and the environment in which the boy was raised, was irreversible, except perhaps by surgically or chemically neutralizing the personality centers of Martin's brain. And that would be a far worse fate than death, to live physically only. If Martin were rational, the man that he could have been, fine and strong like Michael, Martin would choose death to that. John Rourke stuffed one of the scoremasters into his trouser belt and pulled on his old battered brown bomber jacket. Then he went out into the night to walk, to think, hoping that perhaps the fresh air would make it easier for him subsequently to fall asleep. His thoughts shifted to Emma Shaw. The woman was good company and a good cook. More than that, she was a good woman. She seemed to combine so many of the qualities John Rourke loved in Sarah and had loved in Natalia. If things were different, Rourke thought. But they were not. Nor did he regret for a moment that he was married to Sarah, even though he knew she would leave him when she awakened to learn the fate of the child she had nearly died giving birth to, a fate John Rourke would have to fulfill. Rourke sat on a rock overlooking the harbor area, his eyes focused far out to sea. What he needed more than anything else now was for someone's arms to be around him. More than at any time in his life, his soul ached with loneliness. He looked down into his hands. His eyes, always light-sensitive, enabled him to see in the dark. There was movement by his loafer-shod feet. It was a grasshopper, not particularly large, really nothing noteworthy about the creature. Rourke kept his feet still so that he would not inadvertently step on the creature. The grasshopper, like all lower animals, led a much less complicated life. But with the privilege of human thought came responsibility for thought's consequences. The grasshopper just hung around for several minutes, Rourke watching the creature all the while. And then it moved off. Rourke stood up, careful to direct his feet in the direction opposite the grasshopper's path. Life was fragile, Rourke thought, for all. Thornton Rolvag had raised dogs, or had helped his family raise them, since his earliest memories, so he wasn't at all upset that one of them was barking in the pre-dawn hours. A dog might bark because it sensed danger and sought to raise an alarm, or because it experienced some sort of distress, or simply because it felt like barking. But since his dogs didn't usually bark at this hour, he pushed aside the covers and started out of bed just in case.
Thorn?
Some barking. I'm gonna check.
There was another practical concern, of course. Their nearest neighbors were better than a quarter of a mile away, but their children were light sleepers. A good trait, he'd always thought, and might be awakened. He pulled on a pair of shorts, stepped into his slip-on deck shoes, and did one more thing. From the nightstand on his side of the bed, he took up his shoulder holster. He was not a firearms aficionado, but as with most people these days, carrying a gun was for him as natural as breathing, and a fine insurance policy for continuing to do so. As he started downstairs, he looked in at the children's bedrooms. Trixie tossed and turned a bit as the barking persisted. Daniel seemed undisturbed as yet. He took the stairs as silently as he could, grabbing his leather jacket when he passed the hall tree and pulling it on over the shoulder holster and his bare skin beneath. He walked through the house from front to rear, exiting via the kitchen door to the backyard and the dog runs beyond. Raising the oversized Malamutes was not as profitable as raising the smaller pet varieties or the Dobermans, but he had a special interest in these animals. They were all up, awakened by the one which barked. As he approached, the animal calmed and looked at him. There was always one named Hrothgar in the family. Not that these Hrothgars were true physical descendants of the original, who was the companion of Bjorn Rolvag, of course, but for more than a century now, someone in the Rolvag family raised dogs and named one of those dogs Hrothgar. Thornton Rolvag stroked the muzzle of his Hrothgar.
Something's bothering you tonight, isn't it?
Thornton Rolvag drew his hand back and walked along the fence to the entrance, opened it, went inside. Hrothgar sat before his shelter now.
I should have checked for seismic activity, shouldn't I? When will people learn to understand animals, huh?
He played roughly with the dog's ears, Hrothgar loved it, and gave the dog a hug. What was called in the history books the Great Conflagration had one beneficial effect to a man who raised dogs. Among the species of pests wiped out was Tenosophilides canis, the common dog flea.
Hrothgar, you go back to sleep and I'll do what I should have done in the first place, okay?
It was odd how Hrothgar seemed almost capable of understanding, because the dog turned around, winding itself down in a descending spiral until it lay prone beneath the roof of its shelter. Thornton Rolvag left the run, closing the gate, and stopped to give a quick look and a quick pet to each of the Malamutes, then returned to the house. In the kitchen, he took a glass of water from the tap, drank it, then set the glass on the counter over the dishwasher. His coat still on, the night was chilly, he went toward the front of the house, to his home office. As he had anticipated from Hrothgar's behavior, his computer link to the seismographic equipment at the university indicated the volcano was acting up again.
Thornton Rolvag.
Thorn, Betty.
Betty Gilder, his professor during his postgraduate days at the University of Hawaii, was these days technically his boss. But more than that, she was a combination mother figure and good old friend.
I've got the stuff coming in over my computer. Hrothgar woke me up.
I think we should hire that dog of yours full-time, Thorn.
I'll ask him and see what he says.
Think we can get around the fact that he doesn't have a PhD?
I'll loan him mine.
You weren't so flippant when I was your faculty advisor, Sonny.
Yes, Mother. Want me to come in?
No, but do me a favor.
Sure, what?
I'm bushed. Ride herd on it for a little while so I can get some sleep. Then get some sleep yourself and come in by noon, okay?
Fine, I'll call you if there's anything anomalous.
Kiss Ellie and the kids for me.
How about Hrothgar?
Sure.
Get some sleep, Mom.
Right.
Thornton Rolvag set the phone down on the desk. He heard the rustling of clothing behind him and turned slowly toward the sound. It was Ellie, in nightgown, bathrobe, and bare feet.
Betty, right?
Right.
And Hrothgar was playing seismologist again, right?
Right again.
I'm gonna get to bed. Kids have to be at school the same time. They always do. If you're asleep, what time do I get you up?
I'm gonna keep an eye on things for an hour or so, then hit the rack. Get me up by 9 or 10. Have to be at the university by noon.
Want pancakes for breakfast?
Sounds good to me.
Need a sweater?
I can get it.
You watch your computer screen, I'll get it.
Think about the rolling of the surf across the...
Oh, shut up!
By the time she returned with his bathrobe, his slippers, and a cotton afghan in case he got cold, he had the readings coming in from the major sensors. The old one was restless tonight, but he'd seen her worse. Wilhelm Doring set down his suitcase.
Why are there not separate accommodations?
I thought that you and the woman would be...
Yes, Marie.
I don't object to the accommodations if they satisfy you, Willie.
Doring felt the corners of his mouth turning down. He looked back at Stroud, their contact here in Honolulu, and, perforce, their landlord.
Fine. Make certain we get a good night's sleep.
Yes, certainly, Stromban-Führer Doring.
Willie! I am Willie to you and to everyone else! Is that understood?
Yes, Willie.
Good! You may leave us.
Stroud, who was the contract agent to the Gestapo and was so deferential as to be annoying, left at once, bowing slightly as he backed through the doorway of his own building. The building, like many in this section of Honolulu, was largely immigrant housing. Refugees from Eden came here, as did other nationalities, Russians and Chinese in particular, and some wild tribespeople, because Hawaii had employment. There was a booming economy here, the jumping-off point for the Far East and Australia, where there was more employment still. The population of Hawaii was largely technocratic. Consequently, laborers to handle the automated farms stretching along the Pacific toward what was once Japan, and the expansive livestock and agricultural facilities on Australia were in desperate demand. The wages were good. Every iota of data concerning the enemy had been made available to Wilhelm Doring, and he devoured it because even the smallest fact could be of benefit to him in the success of this operation. Stroud had been waiting for them on the beach road with a large electrically powered van. The two wounded men were already stabilized before reaching the beach. Once on the beach, and certain that the landing zone was secured, they had aimed the inflatables back into the shipping lanes, with small, time-detonated charges aboard which would take their engines and thwarts to the bottom after the synth rubber burned. They changed in two-person shifts, except for Marie Dreisling, of course, into civilian-appearing clothing, packing their gear into more of the fabric suitcases they had brought. Doring was taking off his windbreaker as he noticed Marie staring at him. Doring stripped away his body armor vest. Marie was still looking at him. Doring pulled his energy pistol from the waistband of his trousers.
Marie, there will never be anything permanent between us. You realize this?
Yes, Willie.
Then take off your clothes and warm the bed, whore.
Doring went about the apartment, sweeping it for listening devices and optical sensors. He discerned no evidence of any of these. The structure in which they would reside, for the time being at least, was called in the vernacular a condominium. There were various large apartments all within the same general structure. The building itself stood some 10 stories tall and occupied one side of an entire city block. Johann Stroud, the landlord, in the employ of the Gestapo for some 7 years, and considered reliable, was too obsequious to be fully trusted. And Doring was determined to act according to his instincts in all matters concerning the fellow. The condition of this mission deep into enemy territory was a simple one. Wilhelm Doring had complete autonomy, responsible only for getting his job done. How that was accomplished was of no concern. If that meant killing the Gestapo's pet contract agent here, then it would be done. Satisfied that the Spartan-seeming apartment was secure, it was obvious that Stroud had given them the best of those available, Doring went into the bathroom again, but this time not to check for sensors. Wash his hands, urinate, defecate, brush his teeth. Stripped to his underpants, his gun in his right hand, he walked into the bedroom. The drapes were pulled shut and there was a bedside lamp turned on. Marie, covers pulled up to her chin, only her head and her fingertips exposed, lay in the center of the bed. He stripped off his underpants. Marie's eyes flickered over him, then away.
I will do whatever you ask of me, Willie.
I know.
He put his pistol on the nightstand. Later it would go under his pillow, and he turned off the light. He sat down beside her, then swung his legs up as he moved the covers back. He realized that his hands were cold. She shivered when he touched her. Doring drew Marie's face close to his and began kissing her. Women liked their foreplay and were less responsive in its absence. Allied intelligence, while endeavoring to compromise the Eden Defense Computer Network, inadvertently gained access to the Registry of Defense-Related Personnel. It was a considerable list. Although no one in the Transglobal Alliance had thought at the time that such information would prove more than marginally valuable, this was not the case. On at least one occasion of which James Darkwood was aware, the information from the registry had been used to weave a blackmail plot that successfully turned one of Eden's top scientists. The man was later discovered and murdered by Eden security forces. But now, the thrust of the operation was entirely different. Darkwood spoke into his communicator.
Manfred?
Yes?
There's nothing going on here by the rear door. Why don't you start up from the front and meet me in the corridor in 2 minutes?
Right.
The operation against Wilbur Nash, because of its time of day, daylight hours, and location within an alpha-level security area, the housing complex for Eden Defense Plant 234, had to be weaponless. That of itself was enough to make Darkwood's skin crawl. But what lay ahead was potentially far worse. He would exchange places with Wilbur Nash for third shift inside Eden Defense Plant 234. Once the shift ended and Darkwood was out, he hoped, alive, Wilbur Nash would be released and offered the chance to flee Eden for New Germany rather than risk retribution for his unwilling part in the operation. Wilbur Nash was selected because of all the Eden defense workers who had access to Plant 234, he bore the closest resemblance to Darkwood. Their height was identical. Although Nash's build was slighter, Darkwood could mask that by wearing loose-fitting overalls and slouching a bit. Darkwood ascended the rear stairs to the third floor. As he entered the corridor, he saw Manfred Kohl, his counterpart from New Germany, exiting the elevator and turning right. Wilbur Nash's small apartment was to Darkwood's left in the corridor segment between them. Kohl knocked on Nash's door. Darkwood watched the corridor. He heard Nash's door opening and Manfred Kohl's fist impacting Nash's jaw. As Rourke emerged from the bathroom, a towel in hand, rubbing his hair dry, he noticed that the message waiting red diode of his answering machine was illuminated. The counter indicated one message.
Dr. Rourke, this is Commander Washington. Thought you'd like to be in on this, sir. There's a briefing at 0900. It's important. I'll send a driver around in the event you get this message.
Rourke looked at his watch again. 0900 was 15 minutes away. Hurriedly, Rourke dressed. Since he had no idea concerning the nature of the briefing, in keeping with his lifelong dictum to plan ahead, he donned a pair of black ripstop BDU pants, a long-sleeved black cotton knit shirt, and combat boots. He slipped on the SSE shoulder holster with his twin stainless Detonix miniguns, then slid the Miltspark six-pack and a half-dozen spare six-round magazines into his garrison-width belt. He slipped the AG Russell Sting 1A black chrome inside his trouser band and grabbed his leather jacket. The conference room was utilitarian but comfortable. John Rourke took a chair somewhere near the middle of the table, while the remaining personnel, among them uniformed naval intelligence officers and persons in civilian attire who looked as if they had the same occupation, filed in and either sat down or hovered in corners of the room in small groups, discussing things in obvious whispers. Commander Washington entered along with two junior officers, and just behind him was Ed Shaw, Emma's brother from the Honolulu TAC team. There was no military formality here. Evidently, this was a team of men who worked together in such close association that behind these doors, and the doors closed in almost the same instant, the superfluous was left behind. Rourke liked that. Washington took his seat, nodded to Rourke, then looked toward the head of the table. A man in civilian clothes that seemed as nondescript as his face and manner stood at the head of the table and began to speak.
Gentlemen, ladies, we've got a more serious immediate problem than any of us anticipated. Last night, two separate landings were made in the islands. One of these, apparently a large commando force similar in composition to that which our SEALs and the HPD TAC team took out. We've got teams out looking for them. The second landing was a total of 12 persons. That smells like something else besides a straight military unit. They landed very close to Honolulu, and we have reason to suspect they waylaid a car and got into the city. What their mission is cannot be determined.
Excuse me.
Yes, General Rourke.
Is the area where this landing took place cordoned off?
Yes, HPD's got it. Right, Shaw?
That's right.
How about the road where you believe they waylaid the car?
That can be done, Doctor.
If I'm not talking out of turn, then why don't you do that? I believe the Germans have some device that utilizes a laser to bring up latent surface impressions, like a more sophisticated fingerprint detector. Maybe we could use that.
Well, that's a heavily trafficked section of road during daylight hours, General Rourke.
A vehicle waylaid might possibly have stopped quite suddenly, whereas a vehicle waiting to pick up this team wouldn't have.
Good point, Doctor.
Ed took a small transceiver from under his windbreaker as he stood up and started away from the table.
General Rourke, would you care to become personally involved in this?
Indeed I would.
Rourke noticed Commander Washington smiling. After visiting Michael in the hospital, Annie went to where they were conducting their investigation. Along the road, she saw her father and her husband, Commander Washington and Ed Shaw. A uniformed police officer was holding something which looked like an oddly shaped vacuum cleaner with a video monitor attached to it, moving slowly with it along the outside lane of the highway nearest to the beach. She picked her hair away from her face, got it under control again by wrapping her hand around it at the nape of her neck, then joined her father and her husband and the other men along the roadway.
It's me!
Oh, you look pretty.
Annie looked at the vacuum cleaner thing with the video monitor. In the monitor, she could see tire treads and all sorts of scratches and scrapes, which evidently this gadget was picking up off the surface of the road. With the naked eye, she could see a gouge here and there, or some other irregularity, but nothing so detailed. She shrugged her shoulders, opened the flap on her purse, and reached inside for the scarf she carried there. She turned her face into the wind, let go of her hair for a second, then caught it up again, this time knotting the scarf into her hair at the nape of her neck. It worked the first time, and now she had at least one hand free. She stepped up behind her husband, stood on her tiptoes, and looked over his shoulder.
So, what are you guys doing?
Looking for skid marks, trying to get tire impressions. Give ourselves something concrete to go on.
To go on? You've been watching old Dragnet videos or something?
Miami Vice. No, actually, there are footprints leading up from the beach indicating 11 men, two of whom were apparently injured but not seriously, and one woman landed here in the pre-dawn hours.
He's not kidding.
Come on, advanced man tracking 401's in session.
Rourke started toward the beach and Annie fell in beside him. They walked on for about 25 yards until they were near the edge of the surf.
Stop here.
He squatted down over the damp sand.
The wind would have erased most impressions in the dry sand, but here we still have some. Bend down and take a look at this, kiddo.
Annie tucked her dress up close under her thighs as she crouched beside him. She saw impressions of varying sizes and shapes. He started tracing one with his finger.
They were clearer before the wind picked up and pushed the surf, but you can see there's a difference between this heel print and that one, for example. There was one set a few yards down that was very shallow.
The woman?
Good guess, but no. Hers were shallow too, but I could tell the woman's impressions from the width of the foot and the stride. Only known four women in my life who could comfortably match a man's normal stride. You, your mother, Natalia, and Emma Shaw.
Oh.
These impressions merely show a number of men carrying heavy loads, probably equipment. The woman was carrying some stuff too. Either that or she limped badly. But I don't think so. Her left foot impression was deeper than her right. The two wounded men's impressions were a little erratic, but more importantly, they weren't as deep.
Rourke stood up and started into the surf. She hitched up her nearly ankle-length dress and followed him into water that had to be less than an inch below his boot tops.
Right about where we're standing, there were the marks from three inflatables. I found the impression, now it's gone now, washed away, of at least two props. These guys didn't row in. They used silent outboards. Ed Shaw's got people looking on both sides of the road, but the 12 probably set the boats out over the surf and let them go back out to sea, most likely with explosive charges rigged to scuttle them once they were well clear of the coast. The Navy picked up some floating debris this morning from a Russian pirate ship.
Pirates?
Pirates. Lots of piracy on the high seas these days. But they pretty much stink, the Navy. The debris is from a Russian hydrofoil. Probably our 12 invaders booked passage on the pirate vessel and had a falling out, or more likely had it planned all along to scuttle her. This isn't like those commandos we nailed the other day. I'd guess this is some highly trained, highly specialized unit. Maybe an assassination squad, maybe aimed at specific types of terrorism. Hence the woman.
I don't understand, Daddy.
The Nazis historically utilized women, but considered women second-class citizens in many respects. That's the case with the current neo-Nazi movement. If I'm reading this correctly, and it's all supposition at this stage, of course, This group intends to blend in with the general populace on the island, and they brought this woman along as a sort of liaison, thinking we'd never expect them to use a woman and that she could come and go more freely than the 11 men. And the fact that two of the men were evidently wounded, of course, would dovetail nicely into the scenario concerning the wreckage from the pirate vessel, injured in the battle.
All right. What now?
We work with Shaw's tack team to hunt these people down. Unlike our adversaries, we know the value of female operatives. If Natalia can be pried away from Michael, the two of you can pose as tourists. It's the same tourist mecca here that it always was, or whatever works best. Maybe dig around for information.
This is like being a cop in one of those videos from the retreat.
Investigative work. Yeah, I suppose so. The important thing is that we find these people. They won't wait forever to hit their first target, whatever that is, then blend into the population. We have to end their careers as quickly as possible.
They walked back side by side to the roadway. Paul was looking at the video display for the vacuum cleaner thing, Ed Shaw and Commander Washington flanking him.
Better than we hoped for, John. Found some tire treads leaving the road, evidently going off to the side here. The interesting thing is that the tires are perceptibly wider once the vehicle rejoins the road. Could be it took on a heavy load.
It's only one vehicle, and it's probably a van or panel truck.
Agreed.
What we want to do, then, is find a match to this tire tread so we can determine the make and model, then find out what vans usually have these as a factory original equipment. We can measure the distance between treads so we can match up that with the size of the wheelbase. If we're lucky, we'll get a model, make, maybe even a year. And while we're running those down...
You can check all the tire stores on the island in case those were bought as replacements.
Yeah, my thoughts exactly.
Ed, can you find gainful employment for Annie and Natalia Tiamnarovna? They're experienced and they work great together as a team.
Sure can. Certain sections of Honolulu have more extensive immigrant populations. If these people are trying to blend in with the general population, that's the logical place for us to start looking.
And the one thing we shouldn't do is make ourselves any more obvious than we have to be. Our adversaries will be wary at any event. No sense putting them even more on guard for us.
We'll be real discreet, and we'll bust in and nail their asses.
The purpose of a terrorist act, over and above its tactical objective, a bombing, a robbery, an assassination, was always and always would be to instill terror. That fundamental principle was drummed into Wilhelm Doring's head from the very first time that he volunteered for the Sicherheitsdienst, the security service of the SS, the Schutzstaffel. His uniform, which he proudly wore on those rare occasions these days when he did not work undercover, bore both the runic lightning bolts of the SS and the rounded, hooked letters of the SD. Proud as he was of his uniform, he took more pride in his work. And he was especially prideful that, with less than 12 hours on Oahu and two men wounded, he would make his first strike. To instill terror, make fear a constant in the lives of those who were its targets, to replace reasoned response with outraged reaction, it was necessary to strike without warning against a target no one would ever think to harden. It was for this reason that Herr Stroud's van, Gunther at the wheel, was now turning the corner into the parking lot for the Sebastian's Reef Country Day School. The children of many of the higher-ranking officers at Pearl Harbor Naval Base, along with the children of various of the island's officials in government, those of business leaders, and the otherwise prominent, attended this school. The children of a few of the island's prominent Jewish families attended this school as well, and that was all the better. Doring had studied the history of terrorism from its earliest records until the days immediately prior to the night of the war. Men of lesser inspiration and vision would have assaulted the school, then held its occupants hostage against some sort of impossible list of demands, then attempted an escape. Wilhelm Doring had no demands. His objective was terror, not getting an aircraft or large sums of money or having one manifesto or another read on television. The van stopped in a slot near the main entrance of the school. A smallish sign in front of the parking position read, "Visitor." The second van, its occupants local Nazi sympathizers, sincere enough in their devotion to the cause, but an undisciplined, explosively violent lot, according to the reports he'd been given, pulled up beside them. Doring stepped out, pulling his hood down over his face, snapping it into position so the eye and mouth holes were properly aligned. The volunteers were already exiting their vehicle, coming round to stand between the vehicles. Doring spoke to these eight and the eight men with him who were part of his unit.
You know our mission. Shoot as many outrights as you can, then utilize the explosives. We require as many dead as possible. Understood?
There were nods.
Good.
Doring flexed his shoulders out of the raincoat, threw the garment back into the van, and strode out across the black-topped surface of the lot. The late morning felt cool to those small portions of exposed skin remaining beneath the hood. A breeze was blowing in nicely off the ocean. Doring slipped his energy rifle forward on its sling. His own seven men closed in around him. The eighth man, the driver, would wait. They hooded themselves. Doring looked toward the school building. A little girl stared out from the window of a lower-grade classroom, where construction paper cutouts of multicolored birds were plastered to the glass. Doring turned the muzzle of his weapon toward the window and the little girl, who still stared at him from behind it. Tim Shaw's hand dropped the dash radio. Although late 50s wasn't anywhere near chronologically old these days, people were routinely working well into their 80s and living past the century mark and still thriving. Some things made him feel old. The all cars that was just broadcast shocked him so much that he lost his grip on the dashboard radio handset. It would have made him feel old if he'd been 20. Patrolman Linda Wallace, her normally chocolate brown skin gone gray, gripped her hands tighter on the wheel of the car.
What kind of bastards would—
Turn the fucking car around, now! Excuse my language. 1-12 responding. Get every damn unit you can scrounge over to that school fast. I mean fast! I'll quit to Sebastian's Reef Country Day, Linda.
2 minutes, Inspector.
Make it a minute and a half.
He reached across to the rack between them. There was an energy rifle there.
When we hit the scene, you use this. I never liked these things, but you're a good shot with one of them.
Shaw reached into the outside pocket of his black raincoat and found the butt of his revolver, pulled the gun, and checked the cylinder. They were turning into Sebastian's Reef now, the huge, expensive houses and fenced mini-estates going past them on either side in a blur.
Slow it down just enough so we don't wind up driving into something, Linda.
Right, boss. About 20 seconds, and we'll be turning into the parking lot, Inspector.
You block the exit, then use the energy rifle. Get the hell back somewhere in case they want to try their explosives on a police car. Don't be a hero.
Shaw reached to his waist, pulling the stainless steel Colt Government Model 45 from where he habitually nested it, butt outward, between his right hip bone and his navel. As the cruiser rounded the corner, the rolling grounds of Sebastian's Reef Country Day spread out before them, beyond a high, black wrought iron fence. Palm trees swayed rhythmically. Flowers bloomed everywhere. The gates to the school were opened. As they sped past along the driveway, Shaw caught no glimpse of a damaged lock or any sign of forced entry.
Just let the damn gates wide open.
As they rounded a curve in the driveway, Shaw could at last see the main building itself, flames licking upward hungrily against the bright blue of the cloudless sky. There were two vans visible in the parking lot to the far right of the building, one of them already in motion.
Stick with him, Linda. Let me out now.
Linda cut the wheel hard left, the cruiser fishtailing for a split second on the gravel, then whiplashing left, the rear end skidding forward and right in a cloud of gravel and dirt. The first of the two vans sped toward them, bearing down on him. Neither gun he carried was suited to stopping a vehicle, but they were both well suited to stopping men. Energy rifles opened fire at him from the open side door of the van. A body tumbled out of the van just as the plasma bolt struck. Shaw dropped like a stone, rolling onto his left side. One bullet at least struck the safety glass in the rear window of the van and spiderwebbed it. Linda wheeled the cruiser into the driveway and was in pursuit. Shaw was up to one knee and making a tactical magazine change for the 45. He thumbed down the slide release as he got fully to his feet.
Too old for this shit!
The second van was in motion now, starting out of the parking slot. Shaw was into the near edge of the parking lot now, and he ran toward the first car, one of the German jobs from Argentina, so lightweight it side-slipped in a good crosswind. The body was synth glass resin, he knew, but the engine block was steel. Shaw dropped beside the right front wheel well. The block and the suspension system and the tire itself were all that would protect him. As the van picked up speed, Tim Shaw punched the Colt up. The first two rounds made the windshield spiderweb. The next two shattered the synth glass, and the last two nailed the driver as the van started to swerve. The van struck the curb edging the parking lot and bounced over it, tearing across the grass, through the flower bed, then stopping dead against the trunk of a palm tree. The van's synth fuel load exploded. Five men piled out, a sixth man falling from the passenger side of the front seat, clothing aflame. Two of the five men fired energy weapons toward him. Shaw, still in a crouch, edged back. The 45 shifted to his left hand, the 3-inch barreled Smith 38 Special in his right. Two of the other three were running, the third man stumbling, falling, picking up his energy rifle to fire. As Shaw got in easy range, he stabbed the .45 toward the man.
Lucky shot for me, asshole!
The two who were trying to escape were nearly into the trees, and Shaw stopped. The nearer of the two threw down his weapon and raised his hands.
I give up, man!
Wait here!
Oh! Fuck my knee, you motherfucker!
One man left, running into the trees, and a man who'd talk if he wanted painkillers for the knee. This last guy was dead, but didn't know it. Shaw sprinted after him into the trees, one round left in the .38, four in the .45. He could see fleeting glimpses of movement now as the last of the men dodged through the trees and toward the sand and the surf beyond.
Damn, missed! Serves me right for using my left. Shit!
As Shaw neared the far edge of the tree line, he saw the last man, and the man saw him. The energy rifle flew from the last man's hands and his body slumped back into the sand. Shaw, the .45 locked open and empty in his left hand, started forward, ramming the pistol into his belt. Shaw reached with his left hand into his trousers for the little Seacamp DA-32 auto he carried in a pocket holster. A gun in each hand, Shaw came up from the last man's injured right side.
You can't kill me, motherfucker! You're a cop! You figure I'll talk or something. Hitler forever, man! Sieg Heil!
I've already got somebody who'll sing better than you could, asswipe. Heil Hitler? Fuck Hitler, and you too!
No!
Whoever this fellow was behind the wheel of the police car, which had followed them ever since leaving the school compound, he was the best driver Wilhelm Doering had ever seen. No matter the speed, no matter the turn or twist in the highway, they moved along a coastal road with hairpin curves so tight that at times Doering felt certain they would go over the side and crash on the rocks below. The pursuit car maintained a constant distance of approximately 100 meters. The scanning monitor set under the dashboard of the van was locking onto every imaginable law enforcement and police frequency. The Honolulu TAC team was en route. In a matter of moments, helicopters and additional police vehicles would close on them. At last, the van turned onto a straightaway. Doering looked into the back of the van. Hans, whose face was a mass of blood from a wound sustained when the plainclothes policeman had fired through the rear windshield, knelt beside the still-closed rear door of the van.
Are you ready, Hans?
I await your order, Willie.
Bring the vehicle to a complete but controlled stop on my command.
Yes, Willie.
Hans, be ready.
Yes.
Doering looked at Gunther Brach.
Stop now. Fire.
Doering twisted around in his seat. The doors at the rear of the van flew open, outward. The flamethrower Hans fired was pneumatically powered and under such pressure that it could project a tongue of burning synth fuel more than 100 meters against a wind of up to 15 knots. At the moment the burning synth fuel struck the hood and windshield of the police car, Doering stepped all the way out through the passenger side door and onto the road surface. He brought the 40-millimeter grenade launcher, which had been between his legs, up to his shoulder.
Drive!
He threw down the grenade launcher, retook his energy rifle, firing through the open windows of the video drone that had managed to catch up to them. But the little machine bobbed and weaved and evaded his fire.
Hans, the flamethrower, hit the drone!
Yes, Willie.
The video drone was police operated, and through its eye, Tim Shaw and two uniformed police officers had just seen Linda's car destroyed, Linda inside it. It seemed only a second later that the drone itself was targeted and the picture was totally lost. Tim Shaw stalked away toward the trees. He'd only had a few seconds to look inside the school before the arriving fire and emergency personnel had forced him out of their way. In one classroom alone, there were 14 dead children, the bodies of some of them still smoldering from energy bursts at what must have been point-blank range. Shaw took off his hat. He turned his face toward the incoming wind off the sea. He leaned heavily against a palm tree, the heel of his right hand hammering against its trunk. The little kids. Patrolman Linda Wallace. His entire body shook with rage.
Fucking Nazi bastards.
She hadn't expected to see John Rourke, or maybe she had, and that was really the reason why she'd come in the first place, why she stopped to change out of her jeans and into a sundress. Emma Shaw had no trouble getting through the police lines around Sebastian's Reef Country Day School. She'd been showing up at police investigations ever since she was a little girl and her mother died, and sometimes her father had no place to leave her. Emma Shaw was careful where she put her sandaled feet, picking her way around puddles of water, over lines of interwoven fire hose and splotches of foamy white chemical residues from fire extinguishing equipment. Her father, Tim Shaw, his hat low over his eyes, stood talking with John Rourke beside an ambulance that was already filled with black synth-rubber body bags. But none of the bags seemed filled all the way from top to bottom, and with a sickening feeling in her stomach, she realized the bodies of children were inside. Her father stood 5'9" and was a heavy man, barrel-chested and broad-shouldered, not fat. Beside John Rourke, who was well over 6 feet tall and seemed as trim and fit as a professional athlete, he looked short. But Tim Shaw still looked like he could lick his weight in lions with both hands tied behind his back. And Emma Shaw knew that her father could do just that, if he had to, because figuratively speaking, he'd done it lots of times before. She went up to her father, and as he turned around, noticing her, she put her hands on his shoulders. She took a step back and looked at John.
Hi, kid.
I heard. As bad as they say?
Worse, I'd imagine, since we don't have a final body count yet. At least 83 dead children so far, and about 15 adults.
Thought you were on leave.
I am. Can't you see?
She stuck both hands into the patch pockets of her dress and took a step back, flaring its skirt as she did so.
Civvies. You get them?
Should have something better to do than come here, Emma.
I heard you were in a gunfight, so, you know.
Half of them got away, okay? Killed Linda while she was pursuing. Fucking Nazis.
Did someone tell her mother?
That's what I'm about to do.
Come on. I'll take you for a walk.
Emma let Rourke take her elbow and start propelling her toward the palm trees and the surf beyond.
Why did they do this?
Just to do it. It was a good target for a certain type of terrorist. The kind who doesn't care about public image, just wants results. The children of some of the ranking military officers in the islands attend here. The children of a lot of the island's social elite go here. There was no security. It was perfect for them. They just went through and systematically shot to death everyone they could and set explosives. If your father and the dead police officer hadn't arrived on the scene, more might be dead. At least, thank God, there was a field trip today. About 120 children were away for the day visiting the Arizona Monument. Could have been a lot worse.
Dad'll get them.
Your father took out an entire vanload of the men by himself with just a couple of handguns. He's a brave man. You should be proud of him.
I am. But that doesn't mean I want him risking his neck like that. He could have contained them and waited for backup.
Possibly. Now, would you have?
Of course not.
I rest my case. I had a nice time last night, by the way. Thanks for having me over. I must have seemed, awkward. Not that I was ever terrific at social functions, but I haven't had much occasion over the years to relax.
You were fine.
You should be careful on your own. Might even want to cut your leave short.
Well, I don't understand.
This could be the group of Nazis that penetrated the island early this morning. And if it is, that means they're quite efficient. It would only be logical for them to try to strike back at the police officer who killed their compatriots. You'd be a logical target. Do you travel armed?
Emma patted her purse.
Lancer 2570A2 compact right here. Same thing a lot of the Honolulu PD TAC team and SEAL guys use.
A lot of the TAC and SEAL people use 45s too, like your father.
I've got a 45.
Good. Keep the Lancer handy if you need a high volume of fire. It's a great gun, even if it wasn't available in my day. But you might want to have the 45 handy too. No, I'm prejudiced, of course. A good 9mm Parabellum round is just about as effective in terminal ballistics as a 45 ACP, but I've always liked a bigger bullet. The point is, you're vulnerable, especially off base, so be careful.
Even though Emma Shaw knew she should feel warm with the sun on her bare shoulders, she suddenly felt very cold. When she shivered, John put his arm around her shoulders, but he said nothing more. Kronberg studied his own image in the airline's bathroom mirror. His normally deep-set gray blue eyes looked back at him a watery brown, contact lenses, and not so deeply set at all because of the makeup on his face. He wore a steel gray wig that was literally taped to his clean-shaven scalp beneath. The suit that he wore, pale blue, was cut tightly at the shoulders and subtly padded near the waist to help disguise both his height and his physique, making him appear shorter, stoop-shouldered, and slightly pot-bellied. Current men's fashion made the look even easier because jackets and trouser legs were tighter. Kronberg checked the glued-on mustache. It was secure, and replaced the glasses. The glasses, a mild prescription and not just ordinary window glass, gave him a headache, but were necessary. He wore prosthetics, of course, as well, to aid in altering his appearance, and these were uncomfortable. It was a long airplane ride from New Moscow in the Ural Mountains to Honolulu, better than an hour. In the days prior to orbital insertion flight, hundreds of years ago, air travel must have been even more maddening because of the protracted times involved. The prostheses, which fattened his cheeks beneath the makeup, made the real skin beneath itch. That and the prosthesis under his shirt and trousers covering his abdomen, which further enhanced the image of being pot-bellied, made him perspire. But prosthetic fingerprints alone would not have been enough to get him through United States Customs, passing himself off as Boris Luvov, agricultural researcher from Russia. The faces of most major figures in the SS were well known, that of SS Gruppenführer Ernst Kronberg particularly so. And everywhere in the nations of the Transglobal Alliance, security personnel would be watching for him and the others of the Kameraden, ready to arrest or kill on sight. Kronberg left the restroom, returned to his seat, and buckled in. The sky was clear, and all he could see below the aircraft as it descended was the blue of the sky and the water. Soon the islands themselves would be visible, the foam-crested surf lapping against the perfect white sandy beaches. Paradise to some, but only for a little while longer. Midnight tonight. Wilhelm Döring watched the television, sipped at the coffee from the cup Marie had given him. The camera panned, in what seemed an almost sexual fascination with the wreckage of the second van, over the body-bagged men who had been its occupants. Then there was a cut, and a heavy-set but fit-looking man in his 50s became the focus of attention. He wore a narrow-brimmed, high-crowned hat, the front of the brim turned down and the hat low over his eyes. In the eyes, there was a look Döring had seen often, the look of the wolf. This man was identified as Inspector Tim Shaw, head of the Honolulu TAC team, who single-handedly shot it out with the terrorists who attacked Sebastian's Reef Country Day School. This one man had killed all the occupants of the van except one, whom he subdued. This one, Döring bet that it was Fletcher, who had seemed the least dependable of the volunteers from the islands, was expected to provide the police with valuable information concerning the occupants of the second van, who escaped after taking the life of Patrolman Linda Wallace. They showed a picture of the woman, and Döring was frankly amazed that any woman, particularly one from an inferior race, could have driven as well as she did. Although she looked dark-skinned, she was probably quite mongrelized, Döring guessed, and that accounted for her skillfulness and daring.
Can I get you more coffee, Willie?
No.
What can I get you?
Nothing.
He would get what he wanted himself, and that was to make this Inspector Tim Shaw pay dearly.
Time to reload. The Survivalist is continued on the next CD.